It's 8:13 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, the Park City Board of Education meeting yesterday and unveiling the first public look at the high school expansion options. In the studio with details, I have outgoing school board members Nancy Garrison along with Tanya Knauer. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So we have heard for months that there would be three options. Yesterday, I think actually four presented. So what's changed or how come? Nancy?
Well, we realized that through the process of taking a lot of teacher input, a lot of community input, and coming up with these options, these are not the final, these are space design and
conceptual. Kind of conceptual. I mean, and I think they also did add one option to plow over Dozier Field, or, you know, to move Dozier Field, I should say, because honestly, you have to have every option on the table if you're going to say that you looked at everything. And like Nancy said, these are really more conceptual. Like what I really liked about it is, and I think most of the designs had this, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but the area where the gyms are now, that becomes basically kind of a performing arts area, which really fits well with the fact that we've got the Eccles Theater next door. And a lot of these designs take looking at the athletic facilities and kind of moving that somewhere. And so I think as we start our community meetings, we'll be getting more input. And we'll give you those dates as well before we go.
So as we get into this process, I mean, what are the givens? There are none.
The process that has just occurred has identified specific numbers of square feet we need, classrooms we need, where the building is in need of structural improvements. So the criteria has been developed. And now these plans are, I remember the term I was looking for earlier, the plans that we're looking at are about adjacencies. So useful and practical location of spaces. And those things can be moved around, but these are ideas that made sense based on our educator input and our community input and the architects.
The other thing I really liked is they did put up a graph that they really have spent a lot of time before they even got to the putting buildings in places of saying, okay, these are different programming requirements, and these are how much we think. And we're looking at potentially having a school that can fit 2,000 students. And so there is a lot of pre-thought, and like you said, going into before they just start throwing buildings out there.
So what's the current population if we were to add the ninth grade into it?
We'll be right at 1,600.
Yeah.
All right. So this adds another 400 students, and is what you think ultimately the school can hold, or that space can hold, or?
Well, one of the things that we heard from a committee member last night is, and I think the board will need to confirm or refute this, is that when you get over 2,000 students, you really change the dynamic of the experience for the kids and for faculty. And so we would have to decide as a community, do we want a high school that's that large, or do we want a second high school and have two smaller high schools? And so that will be a decision that I would hope is part of this process, because that's the true long-range master planning.
Now, board member Julie Eihausen had mentioned that with the 21st century teaching paradigms that we're developing, there should be common learning spaces and flexible spaces, and the designs presented really don't address those new teaching methods. So are we looking 10 to 20 years out?
Well, we have to make a decision, because collaborative workspace and project-based learning doesn't look like the classroom setup that we have now. And at this point, the design team or the committee has not been informed that that is the kind of high school we're creating. So these are more traditional, standard, non-20th century kinds of designs. And I think that came up last night.
So do we need to relook at this, Tanya?
Well, you know, what I heard last night from the architects, which made me feel a little better about this, because I thought the same thing. I thought, oh, my goodness, are we even designing the right thing? But, you know, when you look at the performing arts spaces and a lot of that, that would stay the same regardless. It's really more how we would build our classrooms and looking at the offices. And that's stuff that we still have time to look at. And what I think is great right now is we have this middle years group with Emily Sutherland, Tracy Evans, and a lot of staff and parents and students looking at this concept for our middle schools. And they've been going all over the place looking at how different schools are doing it. So I think as they start presenting us with a report in February with really kind of driving the direction of how we would do middle school years for the 21st century, I think that will also drive our thinking for the high school. And I think at that point, we can start looking at the classroom space and project workspace and offices and all that stuff and saying, okay, how do we want to fine tune this based on where we want to go? So I don't think it's going to hold us back, and I don't think we're designing the wrong thing. What we're looking for are big concepts. Do we put an athletic facility over here, or do we put it over here?
So my understanding is that we're adding about 76,000 square feet.
Hold on.
Well, I think the numbers last night that were presented to us were about 175,000 square feet total space.
Additional requested square feet.
Okay. All right. No price tags associated with any of the options presented. So when do we start seeing prices?
When we start to narrow in on which conceptual direction we want to go.
But is that a good way to go? I mean, isn't it nice to know? It's like, boy, for this price, we could get this.
Well, I mean, we have to look at the reality of what things cost, and we aren't necessarily going to say, oh, let's spend $20 million if the reality to get what we need is $30 million. Does that make sense? So I do think we want to look at what we really need, and if it turns out to be, like, if you look at the Basin Rec Master Plan, that's huge, and at some point you have to start fine-tuning it, and so I think it will be a collaborative back-and-forth process in the spring when you start seeing the designs come out.
So we'll start to see maybe from the four options down to two before we start to see.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. I think that's what the committee is expecting.
All right. You heard from the district's architect firm, VCBO, that they will be making the options available online to the public with some kind of mechanism for people to comment on each page of the design plans. When does that happen?
December 13th is my understanding of when that link becomes available. And we'll certainly be blasting that out through, you know, our traditional means so people can start going in and taking a look. And then, you know, just... also on December 13th is our first community input meeting, and it is from 6 to 8 at the district office.
Okay, and then we've also got one January 11th at Acker Hill Middle School, and then February 2nd at the Park City High School Lecture Hall is my understanding.
Correct, and they're all at 6 p.m.
Since you two will not be voting on this at this point, do you have a favorite option?
I actually don't, Leslie. I think that what we heard last night are some very good logical arguments for why the space would work in each of those scenarios. My sense is that the community doesn't embrace the movement of Dozier, so the option four. But as Tanya said, if you're going to do a thorough review of options, you look at even those that are less palatable than others.
Tanya, any comment on that?
You know, I don't have a favorite either. You know, the thing about leaving Dozier where it is you do end up with three basically sets of locker rooms. But, you know, it is what it is. You know, I mean, if that's what people want, then I think that everybody's fine with that. I liked the options last night. I think it was some new ideas that we haven't seen before. I really like the idea of, again, bringing the performing arts all together in by the Eccles. I think that, you know, I think that makes a lot of sense.
And you're also going to be doing tours?
Yes.
Yes. So one of our committee members, David Hederly Smith, as well as our principal, Bob O'Connor, and Jamie Sheets, assistant principal, they will be running tours so that the community can see where our buildings are not functioning well and where they really are in need of some serious improvements. And so those tours have not been set yet, but that is, that's the intention.
All right. Moving on, the start time task force, the school board approved a $50,000 budget amendment to cover the cost of a new transportation consultant. It sounds like the board is ready to get to these later start times implemented by next school year. Is that your sense, Tanya?
I think that the school board would love to see that. But we obviously have to look at all the dominoes and make sure that we're covering all of the things that that this is going to set off, from after school care, you know, there's just a lot of things. But, you know, as one of our public comment, Wendy Troxell, what it was last night? No, it was Stephanie Howe, excuse me, said, you know, we have been looking at this for 2 years. We have a ton of data out there. And so I think that there is kind of an expectation that let's get the information together. And what we really need to do before we start going out to the public and saying this is what it looks like is we really need to have somebody come in and do a deep dive for us and help us figure out the busing and the transportation and looking at new ways of doing that. So we could, you know, really start to put together some start time options that people can start looking at.
Yeah, we need to know what it's going to cost, right? Or whether or not we need to buy some big expensive buses.
Right. And quite frankly, while the buses are a huge capital expense, a very real reality is the fact that we cannot at this point recruit and retain bus drivers, and that would suggest that we would need more bus drivers. So there's also long-term M&O costs that are a part of this decision.
So at what point do you think, I mean, where are we in the timeline in terms of getting some start times firmed up? I mean, this expert information put together.
Well, we're just putting the RFP out this week, in fact, this morning, and that will take a couple of weeks to get the hire done. You know, you put the RFP out, you get your applicants, you negotiate. So I would say that work will begin at the first of the year. Stephanie mentioned that in the research of other school districts, the 6 to 8 month window prior to implementation of a change schedule is where the rubber meets the road and where all the work is really intense. So that's going to be early 2017.
I would imagine you'll start seeing stuff in 2017 as well, February, March timeframe, as long as it takes them to start putting stuff together. But the good part is, again, we do have 2 years worth of work already gone into this, so it's not like we're starting from scratch here.
All right. You also heard from the 5th through 8th grade curriculum task force that they'll be presenting some formal recommendations in February. You kind of referenced this earlier, Tanya, but they're in the meantime trying to find some essential aspects of engaging that age group to create some collaborative hands-on learning environments. What should we expect to see between now and then?
I think what you'll see is the results of this group, which has gone out and looked at quite a few schools, just middle schools, and they've taken pictures and looked at curriculum, and they're going to be putting together a formal report that really talks about some of the research that has been done in terms of, we know that this is kids in this age group, they're kind of a different breed. You know, they're not really elementary school. They're not quite ready for high school. And so there are ways out there that we can offer them an education that really draws them in and keeps them interested.
And that was the observation by several of staff that have done these tours in mostly West Coast, I believe, districts, where when they got to the schools, the students were incredibly engaged, you know, just a very different looking environment in terms of how students were behaving, interacting, and progressing in their academic achievement. And that's what we want.
So is this the background that we need before we build the new school?
Right, because what we know is that our program and our academic design is what dictates the space that we need. And so this is the pre-work that gets us there.
All right, just a couple minutes left here, but a review of the Mountain Recreation Master Plan, it outlines an enormous number of facilities, amenities, field houses, ice arenas, aquatic centers. Really very unclear, though, what the school district is going to be responsible for funding. The draft shows the facilities dispersed throughout the entire county. I mean, we had heard, I think, a price tag of some $21 million to build a rebuild, really, the Ecker Hill Middle School facility. So Do we know what are school district projects and what are community projects?
I have to say I'm not clear on that.
I don't think anyone is clear on that. I mean, I think the way that someone explained it to me on that committee is they're really kind of in the dream phase right now. I mean, and they're starting to kind of narrow it down. And then once you get to some pieces that obviously impact the school district, which is going to be Kearns specifically, you know, then we will obviously have to start talking about that. And the bottom line is it really comes out of everybody's pocket, regardless of which budget it comes through. So it's really a matter of marketing it the right way so we determine what we need and how we're going to pay for it.
But let's talk really briefly about the Dozier athletic facility. They've talked about this being built next to Dozier Field.
Are you talking about the little house?
Well,
or
just
the locker
new
rooms,
Yeah. Right. So that's going to – and that's based on the Dozier Field staying where it's at?
Correct.
All right. And then there's also talk about perhaps a new field house, indoor field house, perhaps where Treasure exists?
Correct.
That's on – that's the regional master plan's idea, not necessarily what the school district is planning right now. And I think that's the tension that exists, is these are needs of the community. These are logical spaces for these buildings to be placed. And does the community want the buildings there?
Well, as part of the bond election, you did have an indoor field house there, right?
Right,
correct.
Right there. And it was clear that was not desirable.
Well, I think what we heard loud and clear is that people don't want to see something like that on a school bond. Now, whether it becomes part of a recreation bond, that's a whole other story. And, you know, we do have a fairly good history of sharing facilities. If you look out, obviously, at Ecker, that's on our property. But that is, you know, the building of a bigger pool, that's not going to come out of the school district budget. I can guarantee that. I can almost guarantee that one. But we do a really good job of managing that together and having it on our space. So I think the same thought is going into the school, the field house, is that potentially it could be on our space and it would be used by our kids and there would be some sort of cooperative agreement in terms of how it's managed. I think that's the thought, but obviously that would need to be figured out, you know, as we would look at our interlocal agreement again.
Okay, I need to leave it there. Nancy Garrison, Tanya Knauer, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie.
KPCW News Time now, 8:30. We'll be talking with City Manager Diane Foster and planner Hannah Turpin. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. KPCW News Time, 8:31. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, the Park City Council has an issue-oriented meeting tomorrow. In the studio with details, I have Park City Manager Diane Foster, Community Development Director Ann Laurent, and Planner Hannah Turpin. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning. And it is issue-filled, and we had a great meeting yesterday with City Council and Summit County Council after a ribbon cutting for the new transit center and the new clean diesel buses with Wi-Fi. So we're all about issues these days.
Well, I want to. The transit taxes don't kick in into the middle of next year. So, what do the two governments do in the meantime to improve transit?
We've actually started working already. As you know, staff had put together all the projects before the tax, and to say to the community, "This is what we will do." And what you see staff doing now is actually putting stuff into place. So staff has been meeting every week since the election, and we sat down with the elected officials and just laid out what we're doing as far as increasing transit service. There are some transit service increases for this year already, making those improvements and what the timeline is for the rest of them.
What about the Prospector route? Did you hear anything about that? I know a meeting was held yesterday.
Yeah, not at the we didn't hear about it at the joint meeting. However, there was a we did notice that a majority of council would be at Sally Elliott's house last night. There were some concerns from Prospector residences. We had changed the bus route there so that it wouldn't take a left turn coming out of Wyatt Earp, because it's really, with traffic on 248, really hard for a bus to get out there and not really that safe. So now that we're taking right turns, which is much more efficient, there was concern that the bus wouldn't go directly to – we also had a route change that it would go directly to Deer Valley, which it's never gone to directly, and it wouldn't go directly to PCMR. So what our transit staff is going to do is run a pilot program. So we're going to have a direct bus to both ski resorts from Prospector, and it's going to be a pilot program because if it doesn't get the ridership, we'll have to cut it next year. So the community and Prospector, we really appreciate their warm reception on that and that they were enthusiastic about getting their neighbors out and getting increased ridership.
Roger Armstrong raised an interesting question at that joint meeting last night. What transit can be implemented to help workers who finish at 2, 3 in the morning to get them home?
Right now, we don't have that service. I think we ended about midnight. However, I think over time you will see us change that. We're also looking at some other services in Aspen. We saw a service called the Downtowner, and our staff has worked with them, and that's providing supplemental service. We do have council direction in the short range transportation plan to provide a service into neighborhoods with basically you would dial a ride and it would drop you off at the nearest bus stop.
And when can we get some practical links to, say, the hospital, the National Ability Center, and perhaps more importantly to the Justice Court, given that some of the people that are headed there are because they don't have a driver's license for one reason or another?
I think we're in actually pretty good shape on those. Alfred Knotts has been working with the Utah Department of Transportation, and we have a good timeline for bringing online the hospital, Park City Heights, and Richardson Flats Park and Ride. So we'll see that. We're on a kind of a two-year timeline on that one. As far as the Justice Court, you can actually get there now if you get off at near the Fieldstone Homes in Silver Springs. There's a bus stop there already that goes through Highland Estates and comes up through. So you can get off there and then walk just rock across the bridge over to the Justice Court. I know it's a walk, but that's okay.
It's a walk. On affordable housing, most interesting comment I think was Tim Henney, pretty upset about the holdup at Park City Heights making the affordable units available. He says it's unexcusable. He wishes they could find some way to enforce the timelines on affordable units. And Laurent, you say that things could happen as soon as tomorrow?
Yes, as I mentioned last week on the radio, Leslie, had a delay. We had a proposal and then it was rescinded. But last week we also got a revised pricing for the first 10 units from Ivory Homes, and we're in conversation. So we changed our update to talk a little bit about releasing those homes. We know there are people out there waiting and we want to make that happen for them. So we're going to talk a little bit about that, and we're also having another meeting today, and we're working really hard to be back hopefully at the December 15th meeting to talk about all the pricing again if we're successful.
Are we coming closer together on the pricing?
I think we're coming to a closer understanding of you know, how can we meet the needs and meet the resolutions, but yet still have product that matches prices that makes sense.
Yeah. What about those who have their name on one of those homes? I mean, are they going to be surprised by this? Are they going to still be able to afford one of these?
The pricing for the first units, the townhomes specifically, is not anticipated to change at this point. So no, we don't believe people will be surprised. I think it's only 10 people right now that have been promised homes and have been given pricing.
All right. So that you say wouldn't come up until the December 15th agenda?
No, we're going to talk about the first 10 units at the meeting tomorrow, and then we're pushing really hard to get the balance of the pricing the following week.
All right. Another closed session at tomorrow's meeting. Diane, any update on Bonanza Flat and whether Park City even has a chance of purchasing this property?
As far as I know, we don't have any new news on Bonanza Flats. And actually, just to follow up on Ann's point, we will be republishing the City Council packet today with that staff report. And just want people to be aware, we usually get everything published on Monday. Staff has been working so hard on this and going back and forth with Ivory Homes. And we want to make sure we get the right information in the report. So we delayed that and we'll be republishing today.
Okay, but no news on Bonanza Flats?
Not yet.
At 3:30, a 45-minute discussion on the proposed Rocky Mountain Power net metering changes and what impacts could be approved or could happen if approved by the Public Service Commission. Council has sent a letter to the PSC. What did the letter say?
The letter said, we're not happy about this. We don't like this. And the city's very concerned that of the possible chilling effect of the changes in net metering. The pricing is likely to, and if you see surveys that have come out in the Salt Lake Tribune, the pricing is likely to functionally kill the solar market. In fact, I understand that even Robert Redford has a op-ed in Time magazine this week about how this will really hurt solar in Utah. So the city's going through a two-step process. One is that we've formally filed because the Rocky Mountain Power actually split this filing with the Public Service Commission. And so our first piece was to make sure we got public input in on time. The second piece is, and we'll be taking this in two steps, Luke will be coming back next week to council to formally ask if they want to file to intervene in this rate case.
So how would the changes impact Park City's net zero goals? I mean, does it just do away with them?
No, it doesn't do away with the net zero goals. And in fact, we are working hard with Rocky Mountain Power. You know, this is one of those, a test of a good relationship is, can you have a fight? So we're having a fight on this particular issue, and we're going to fight it hard. But we're working quite cooperatively and working hard with them. And they've been a terrific partner on the net zero piece. You know, subscriber solar, they've argued is what everyone should do instead of rooftop solar. But as a rooftop solar customer, I like my solar on my roof. But the net meter, the subscriber solar stuff has been just terrific. And we've really appreciated that. And we're working hard with them on finding a solution for the whole community to get net zero.
Well, Rocky Mountain Power says it's a fairness issue that people, you know, should pay their fair share to have that rooftop solar so it doesn't burden the rest of us. Opponents, however, say it's really just a profit issue. Where do we fall on this?
I think what you'll see staff come out and say is actually argue with the math, right? So it's saying that each solar customer costs Rocky Mountain $400. We're offsetting $400 a year for other subscribers, other electricity customers, and I don't believe the, you know, should I be paying as a solar customer? Should I be paying for using power lines? Absolutely, because I rely on Rocky Mountain Power as a backup to our solar system. So I should absolutely be paying for it. Is it the amount that they're saying it is? I don't believe it's that high.
Yeah. And you're also working with Rocky Mountain Power on perhaps a pilot project for the Lower Park Avenue project?
I haven't heard about that, but that would be great.
All right. Let's turn to you, Hannah, at 4:15, a half-hour discussion on the Main Street Storefront Enhancement Program land use controls. What's the concern here? I mean, I think as I read in the packet, it's really whether or not Park City's Main Street stands out from other resort towns.
Yeah, so the Planning and Economic Development departments were tasked with addressing conventional chain businesses and retail mix on Main Street. And so our biggest concerns are historic preservation, vibrancy, and then the plan for the future economy. And so what we did was we created the Storefront Enhancement Program, which is just a five-pronged approach consisting of tools that we already had. So we looked back and saw what was already working.
Yeah, so is it just the creep of chain stores that we're trying to avoid?
I think it's sort of it's a very complex issue because what we have are franchises that are actually owned by community members. You have the risk of future chains coming in. And so what we wanted to do was just look at it from a broader perspective and what makes Main Street and Park City unique.
Yeah, I mean, certainly we can point to the fact that Main Street has lost some of its more funky businesses. You know, gone is Expanding Heart, the Christmas store, and what it feels like is a bunch of new galleries. So, I mean, this is private property. Can the city really do anything to make a difference in what we see on Main Street?
Yeah, I think it's a challenge. I mean, what we did was we took a step back and looked at the tools that we already had and what had worked in the past. And so we're really going to lean heavily on our existing protections for the historic district, our land management code, and then the design guidelines.
All right. So when you talk about the five strategies, what would those include?
Their historic district and then our National Register protections, our design guidelines, shared economy model and cultivation of incubator spaces, land management code regulations, and then future RDA potential.
Yeah, but so how does that then prevent, say, Applebee's coming onto Main Street?
So the goal is we're proposing three different land management code changes. The first is to define conventional chain stores. The second is to define corporate architecture. And then the last is to limit storefront width abutting Main Street and Heber Avenue to 50 feet. We are not proposing a width requirement on Sweet Alley or the western boundary of the HRC. And so the goal is to keep that traditional rhythm and scale. It's not going to say no to chain stores from coming, but what it's going to do is keep that traditional rhythm and scale of the street.
So would those changes then prevent, say, an Applebee's restaurant?
No, we are not. We're not proposing a prohibition on chain stores.
But it would make it more difficult for it, too.
It would be challenging for them to come in.
And I think the rents just for where Applebee's normally would be a little bit rough.
Well, but that's part of the problem here because the rents
Absolutely.
Are so high that, you know, you can no longer sell Christmas tree ornaments.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think one of the things you'll see long term and that Hannah mentioned in that is, do we look long term at the activation of Sweet Alley? And is there the opportunity for the city you know, we own some property, and can you put a storefront in front of China Bridge? These are all questions. These are policy questions at first for city council about, you know, do you want to change? I think in 100 years, we will absolutely see Sweet Alley become activated. And it's interesting because it'd make Main Street even, I think you'd increase the vibrancy of Main Street if you had just kind of more retail density here.
Finally, under new business, a possibility to amend the affordable housing mitigation plan for the medical campus at IHC. My understanding is that IHC is proposing that the increased square footage, they've got a housing obligation of nearly 11 affordable unit equivalences, but they want those credited in return for a cash donation to the Peace House of more than $1 million, and staff's recommending that be denied. How come?
We are, because if you look at the overall IHC housing obligations associated with the initial development, and you look at how they've been fulfilled to date, it's produced very little to no actual workforce units within Park City. So it's either been done through transfers or and there was already some credit given to the Peace House construction and through a land lease. And at this point, given what's left and given where we are with affordable housing, we really believe that the remainder of the obligations should produce workforce units.
I thought they were part of the whole Park City Heights.
They are a portion of it, and that is the only portion right now that's resulting in units, and they haven't yet, but that's part. The townhomes, yes, are fulfilling 28 of those AUEs.
Okay. Need to leave it there. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
KPCW News Time now, 8:45. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW.
This
will Park City Sunday, producing their annual Park City Holiday Bazaar. In the studio to tell us more about that, I have Executive Director Kate McChesney. Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, this weekend?
This weekend, yeah. Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Friday will be from 5 to 9, Saturday 10 to 6, and then Sunday, we say 10 to 2, but 2 is kind of a soft close, depending on the weather, you know, it just depends. But our vendors will always stay open, and Santa will be there the entire time.
Okay.
Free photos.
Where is it?
It's going to be at the Marriott on Sidewinder. So there will be some signage that will go up Friday night, but it's the Marriott over on Sidewinder in Prospector.
All right. Free to get in?
Free to get in.
Mm-hmm.
Totally free to get in. Again, free photos with Santa. And then there is a bar and restaurant on site and free parking, too. So no reason not to come and shop.
All right. How many vendors do you have?
We have just about 90 vendors. Yeah, we take over the entire hotel, so the entire banquet rooms, some of the hallway areas, and we sack them in there. And because we did it last year, we, you know the layout. We know where we could add a few more, you know, less congestion. But at the same token, we want to give everybody, you know, a lot of bang for their buck.
All right. Now, are these many of the same vendors that you see on Sunday?
So it's a little bit of a mix, actually. A lot of our vendors during the summer are very summer-oriented vendors, so a lot of T-shirts and a lot of hats, whereas this is very Christmas-oriented or holiday-oriented, so gloves and mittens. We have quite a few gourmet foods, which are always great, especially because it's Utah's own gourmet food. So if you're looking to send any gifts home or just looking to make great gift baskets, this is going to be the place to come, as well as jewelry, potters, photographs, you name it. But yeah, it's probably, I would say, maybe a 50-50 mix of vendors that you'll have never seen at Park City versus vendors that you'll see every Sunday.
Okay. And you do this just to do one more thing in the winter, huh?
Just because we have nothing else to do. No, it's actually a huge fundraiser for us. So we don't do a gala. We don't do an auction. We are another local nonprofit here in town. So this, we actually make the money off of the vendors. They pay a flat rate to us, and that goes towards our, you know, summer operations with, you know, being one of the, you know, best green events all summer long, or all actually year long. These types of, you know, this fundraiser for us actually gives us the money to help us with, you know, continue being green, continue giving free space on Main Street to a lot of the other local nonprofits. And so, yeah, it's our one and done kind of fundraiser.
Okay. Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Park City Marriott. Park City Sunday Market received just a 1-year contract for next summer. I know you were hoping for more.
Yeah, it was, well, they've got the new event committee, SEAC, and with this being created and then all of a sudden really starting to look at all the events that happened during the summer, I mean, 10 years ago, we were one of three major events that happened in this town. Now we're one of 80 events that happen in this town. So I get it. I understand. But all of a sudden, creating this particular committee, it really looked as though it was just going to be a chopping block all over the place. And so we asked for a one-year extension to City Council, which they also felt was, you know, something that would be a really easy solution just to give us, you know, get us already on the board for 2017. Our application is open for 2017. So those types of, you know, just being able to continue doing what we do.
Yeah. Have you outgrown Main Street?
I don't believe so, just because this year we had one of the biggest 4th of Julys, and 4th of July falling, you know, on that same weekend. It fell on a Saturday, and then here we are on a Sunday. So there were thousands of people, and we actually showed 22,000 people. And I remember there was a particular city official that happened to be on Main Street that looked up Main Street and said, wow, if this is, you know, one of the busiest weekends, it was a calm day. I mean, definitely there was a lot of people, but it was a calm day. And, you know, we still had 22,000 people on Main Street, and it felt like we could have more. I don't necessarily know that that's what we want, but it was still a pretty calm day.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So Main Street, you feel like is your
yeah,
home.
I do. I can't imagine us anywhere else. You know, as far as the Park Silly Sunday Market, I feel like, you know, with the arts and culture initiative that everybody is starting to bring into this town, I think that we are one of the bigger arts and cultural, you know, events that are happening here on Main Street.
Yeah. And I think probably the biggest complaint from Old Town residents is that it's just every Sunday. I mean, would you guys consider backing off of some of those Sundays? And I know you give up two, but we've got the Arts Festival and then the Tour of Utah.
Tour of Utah. Correct. It's one of the things that is part of the conversation that we're having. And it's just a matter of, you know, marketing an event such as this. Even when we're not there, there is something else happening. So when people do come to Main Street expecting to see something happening, that's really what it's about, is people coming up from Salt Lake or people who are in town traveling and they've been hearing about these great markets or great events that are happening on the weekend. It's going to be very difficult to all of a sudden, when my phone rings, which it does, and my phone rings and people are a little ticked off going, where are you? What happened? You're supposed to be here. And so if we do start cutting some Sundays, I want it to be strategic so that, you know, maybe it's the first one and the last one, so that the marketing wouldn't show it too much, where it's like, oh, it's the third Thursday. No, it's the second Tuesday. No, it's this, you know. So it needs to make sense for everybody.
All right. So, but you'll be back.
We are with
the same number.
You got it. We'll kick off June 4th, and we'll go all the way through September 17th of next year.
Okay. So, Anything else, Kate, you wanted to mention?
I just wanted to mention that, you know, this year with our Holiday Bazaar, one of the things that we are doing, which it was unbeknownst to me until last year, is that all of our vendors, in addition to paying us the $225, all of our vendors are going to be paying $149 in a special event business license to the city. So just an FYI, I mean, we are doing our part in making sure that we're following the rules, and our vendors are pretty much going to be cutting a check for almost $15,000 to the city to hold this event at the Marriott because it's private property. So just wanted to show, you know, just show that we do follow the rules. We're here for everybody, and we just want to always make sure that we're doing the right thing.
All right. Well, hopefully people show up so they can recoup some of their costs.
Yeah, amen.
Okay.
Thanks,
Kate,
Leslie.
Thanks for coming in. We now in the studio from the Citizens Climate Lobby, I have Judd Warner. Good morning, Judd.
Good morning, Leslie.
So you've got a public offering on Monday night. Tell us about that.
We do. What we're offering is a public viewing of a Years of Living Dangerously episode. We're going to air that episode at 6:30 p.m. at the Santee Auditorium. The reason why we're offering this particular episode, Leslie, is because it features our organization, Citizens Climate Lobby, and a substantial initiating role that one of our members had in establishing the Bipartisan Climate Solutions Congress caucus in the U.S. Congress.
Okay, so it's free, open to the public. Just show up, and it's what, a half hour, an hour long program?
It's a little bit short of an hour long. and just show up. It's going to be informal for anyone who wants to show up a little early. We're going to be having our monthly meeting at the Park City Wasatch Back chapter of Citizens Climate Lobby starting at 5:30. So if you want to show up a little early and meet some of our team, we'd love to meet you.
All right. How many members are you up to?
Well, we have 34 people signed up online, and we'll see how many people we can get to show up on Monday.
All right. So how did you get access to be able to show this?
The National Geographic made it available to us. And so I have the episode on DVD. And actually, people who want to watch it can watch it on television tonight. It actually airs live tonight at different times, depending upon whether you have DirecTV, Xfinity, or who your carrier is. And it's also available online through the National Geographic channel. So I guess if there are listeners who can't make it Monday night but still want to see the episode, I would encourage you to find it online, watch it live tonight, or find it online. But if you want to join a group of us and watching it on a big screen and get to meet some of the Citizens Climate Lobby volunteers and hear a little bit about our organization, we'd love to meet you on Monday night.
Okay. So does Citizen Climate Lobby have a fight in the Rocky Mountain Powers proposal to up the solar rooftop fees?
We definitely have an opinion, and we're definitely supportive of maintaining the status quo there. We're not necessarily active in that fight. Our issue, Citizens Climate Lobby's issue, is carbon pricing. We have a particular form of revenue neutral fee on carbon called carbon fee and dividend that we are promoting, and we would like to see Congress pass national legislation implementing a carbon fee and dividend proposal.
So does that happen? Have a chance? Ever have a chance, given that President-elect Donald Trump's moving into the White House and basically says that climate change is a hoax?
We believe it does. We believe it does. Obviously, the data's on our side, and we believe that the political will for something like this resides with the people. And just to give you an example, the way that we were successful in establishing the Climate Solutions Caucus is one of our volunteers brought endorsements from 55 mayors, city councils, scientists, university presidents, and major business interests in South Florida to this one particular Republican representative there, and said, this is the will of your people. And he happened to also have some acceptance of the science, and that's what we need. Yeah.
So does your goal, does it align with what I've heard New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman talking about, basically doing away with all corporate taxes, but instituting, he would say, a sugar tax and then a carbon tax. Is that the idea?
Well, we don't take a stand on other carbon taxes, our revenue neutral fee on carbon, and it's something that's not a new idea. In fact, it's been in place in British Columbia since 2008 with very successful results. They've reduced their carbon emissions by about 15%, and the public perception of the fee has increased by 20 percentage points, and it's very successful. So and we have analytical data, of course, that shows that that it is a net benefit to the economy. Over maintaining our dependence on fossil fuels, it's revenue neutral in that all the fees that are collected by the government are returned to the economy. In our particular scheme, they come back to individuals, and individuals then spend the money to stimulate the renewable energy transformation.
Okay, Judd, I need to leave it there. Thanks for your time this morning.
You bet. You're welcome.
Thank you. Again, this free screening will be held Monday night, December 12th, 6:30 to 8 at the Jim Santee Auditorium. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW.